Welcome, everybody, to the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ray Shasho, and welcome to the show where we spotlight legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or visit www.publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Our very special guest today is the legendary frontman for the Tubes, Fee Waybill. Born John Waldo Waybill in Omaha, Nebraska, the name Fee came by way of a bass player who thought Waybill looked like the King of Fiji, pictured on the cover of a National Geographic magazine, and began calling him Fiji, which eventually was shortened to Fee. Fee was raised in Scottsdale, Arizona, where he sang and acted in elementary school assemblies, which led to musical comedies in high school, and then on to Arizona State University as a drama major. After moving to the mountains of northern Arizona to find his muse and living on brown rice and imagination, he was enticed without much difficulty into being a roadie for the Red, White, and Blues Band on their way to San Francisco to make it big in the music business. Fee started singing background vocals, and eventually the band combined with another Arizona band to become The Tubes in 1973 with Fee as frontman and lead singer. The Tubes recorded 10 LPs for A&M and Capitol Records from 1974 to 1985 and were headliners on their first tour with 8 dancers, 7 band members, 6 on-stage TV monitors, wild acts, and an entourage of 35, including a pyrotechnic advisor, a video supervisor, and 2 costume mistresses. In 1984, Fee recorded his first solo album, Read My Lips, and collaborated for the first time with Richard Marx. The pair has gone on to co-write over 30 songs for their own projects as well as for other artists. Fee left the Tubes after the 1985-86 tour to write and act and take a break from 14 years of touring. Moving to Los Angeles in 1986, Fee has since written lyrics for movie soundtracks as well as musical artists such as The Tubes, Richard Marx, Kenny Loggins, Toto, Steve Luthaker, Pat Leonard, Vixen, Emerson, Drive, and others. Since 1991, Fee has won 6 BMI Performance Popularity Awards in recognition of his outstanding songwriting. His acting credits include Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventures, Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains, Private Eye, Bouncers, STV, MTV guest VJ appearances, along with 3 books on tape and various voiceovers on commercials. 1994 brought the Tubes back together with Fee for a long tour of Europe and a welcome reunion. The band has continued to play their unique brand of rock and roll, adding new songs to the mix of the already popular. Don't Be Scared by These Hands was released in 1996, Fee's second solo CD, followed in 1997 by the 11th Tubes release, Genius of America, the 12th Tubes World Tour 2001, and latest CD and DVD releases in 2004, the Tubes Wild West Show. Fee continues to live in Los Angeles. He enjoys scuba diving, water skiing, and hiking with his dog. He is also an avid polo player and owns 4 horses. He supports animal rights causes and participates in a number of celebrity charity events each year, including Richard Marx's Sea of Charity Show, Alice Cooper's Solid Rock Foundation Golf Tournament, and ESPN's annual charity golf tournament. His interests also include Mayan ruins, history and art of the American West. He is also a member of the Barn Theater in Augusta, the oldest for-profit summer stock theater in the U.S., and has reprised his role as Frankenfurter in the Rocky Horror Show 6 times. Since Fee's first tenure at the Barn Theater in 1999, he has revived the theatrical presentation of the Tube Show, including props and more than 10 costume and character changes in the current show. After a busy summer schedule, Fee is thrilled to take a break and reprise his role for the 6th time as Frankenfurter at the Barn. Fee says, "It's like a vacation for me to come back to the Barn to do Rocky again. It's so much fun, and I feel so welcome. I guess old Barneys never die. They just start stumbling over their lines in high heels. In July 2015, the Tubes started a 40th anniversary European tour, including dates in Germany, Sweden, and the UK. Dates in the U.S. followed. Some of the Tubes' biggest hits include Don't Touch Me There, White Punk's on Dope, Prime Time, Don't Want to Wait Anymore, Talk to You Later, Gonna Get It Next Time, She's a Beauty, Tip of My Tongue, The Monkey Time, and Piece by Piece. The Tubes continue touring the U.S. and Europe in 2016. It is my great pleasure to welcome Tubes legend, Fee Waybill, to the Ray Shasho Show. Hello, Fee.
Hey. Hi, Ray. Well, that pretty much covers it. Okay. I really don't have much more to say.
Well, we're done. See you next time.
Thanks a lot. You know, we can do this Wikipedia interview and then we're done. Okay.
I'm telling you. I like to refresh people's memories, you know, let everybody know about your great career. And it has been a great career.
Well, thank you.
You guys are currently on a pretty large tour right now, right?
Well, we're gearing up for another big tour of Europe, and we're doing a bunch of these packaged 80s shows in the USA. It's Rock of the 80s package and Rock Legends package, and there's a whole bunch of 80s kind of package. The current one we're on is Rock of the 80s is the Tubes, the Motels, and Smithereens open.
Oh, wow.
And then we have another 80s package thing we do with the Tubes, John Waite, and who's the opener? Oh, Rick Derringer is the opener for that one. And we do club dates, we do casino dates, we do whatever, whatever really makes sense for us to do, In between my rushing off to the barn to do Rocky Horror. Although last time I was at the barn, I did Spamalot. Oh my God!
Oh, cool.
Spamalot was the best. I played King Arthur in Spamalot, and it was the most fun I have ever had on the stage. It was classic. Eric Idle is a genius, and I was, been a huge Monty Python fan for years and years from the very beginning, and to be able to do that was just the best. It was so much fun.
You actually got to meet Eric Idle as well, right?
I did get to meet Eric Idle, yes. Right after I did it, and it was kind of, it was like last summer after I had done Spamalot, and I couldn't shut up. I just went on and on and on. You must have thought I was another psycho fan, but... Yeah, I met him at a party up on Mulholland I can't remember the guy's house I was at, where Eric would live next door. The guy from Price is Right, not Bob Barker.
The guy with the glasses?
The guy with the glasses. Whose line is it anyway?
I can't remember his name either.
Okay.
Okay,
in the middle of the interview.
I know what you're talking
about. His name,
yeah.
Greg Proops. Greg Proops, the comedian, is a very good friend of mine. He was part of the Whose Line Is It Anyway cast, and the moderator, the guy who was the moderator of and he used to be really fat, and he lost to like 100 pounds or something. Now he's a skinny guy on Price is Right. Anyway, Eric Idle lives next door to him on Mulholland up in the hills.
Oh, okay.
So I was at his house for some rap party, end of season party, and Eric walked over from next door, and I just lost it completely. Oh my God, the guy's just a genius, and he's got a new. Have you heard about What About Dick?
No, I have not.
What About Dick is a radio play that Eric Idle did online with a big cast, Eddie Izzard and Russell Brand and all kinds of people. And it's like a radio show where they stand in, and read a script. He calls it oral theater. But it's really funny. It's really, really funny. What About Dick? So if you run across it, you can download it, I think, for like $6.
Oh, okay.
just classic Eric Idle, just double entendres left and right. It's just the greatest.
I think the guy we were trying to remember was Drew Carey.
Drew Carey.
Yeah.
You're right.
It just came to me.
What? Where? How could I forget that?
I want to say the tour, actually, I'm in Florida, and I'm in the Tampa Bay area. I live probably, 30 minutes from Clearwater. You guys, the Tubes, will be there on June 3rd at the Capitol Theater. So I want to remind everybody to get your tickets for the Tube show at the Capitol Theater in Clearwater. And
right, that's the Rock Legends. That's with John Wade. That's the John Wade package.
That's with John Wade, right. Yeah, that's going to be an awesome show.
Yeah. He's really great. We've played with him many times before. And he's a really a good guy and a great band. It's a great, great package, I think, with us and John. It's great.
Yeah, I love these package deals that you guys are playing. And I mean, it just makes things so fresh every time you come out there with different people.
Every promoters like it. They can draw on, three or four different bands' fans. And it seems to work. I mean, everybody likes it.
I talked to John Payne. I had him on the radio show.
Oh my God!
He was talking about the show. I guess he kind of put together.
Right, Rock Pack.
Yeah, that was awesome. And he promised more shows. And you guys were playing Fort Myers at the time.
Right.
That featured, oh my God, Mickey Thomas, Bobby Kimball of Toto, Steve Walsh of Kansas, Robin Zander, and you guys, and John Payne.
Right. That was really great. And a bunch of insanely good musicians from Vegas. I mean, the band was unbelievable. I mean, I was stunned. They were so good. And, we rehearsed a couple of, they ran through. I went out there a day early. We rehearsed my songs, and it was just, like, flawless. I couldn't believe it. I just, okay, great. We're done. See ya.
Yeah, I love the Ringo tours. I've covered Ringo a bunch of times, and it's all-star band, and the, the Hippie Fest tours and, all the blues tours that are, there's tons of tours out there now.
I know. Everybody on earth is still touring. Everyone. Yep. If you're not dead, and I hate to mention, the dead, especially now that we just lost Prince, which really sucked.
Yeah.
But everybody else is still out there.
Yeah. I just wish you guys would get more mainstream play because you guys are still making great music, and they got to play this crummy dance music over and over again on mainstream radio.
There's no rock and roll. If you want to hear rock and roll, you're not going to hear it on the radio.
You're going to
hear it at a live concert. Yeah. That's why everybody is, and nobody's making any money downloading, one 99-cent song from iTunes. So everybody's out on the road. Everybody is out on the road working.
The current lineup of you guys, it's Roger Steen, Prairie Prince.
Right.
Rick Anderson and David, is it David Med?
David Med is our
David
keyboard
Med.
Player. He's the only non-original member.
Right. Prairie Prince has been out there performing with all kinds of people.
Prairie works constantly. He's a great, great drummer, and everybody, he's out with Todd right now, Todd Rundgren right now for pretty much the month. And sometimes we work, depending on the gig, sometimes we have a couple of substitute drummers that we use. But for the most part, if it's any kind of a big deal gig at all, I won't do it without Prairie because Prairie's the best. He's just, nobody can compare. I mean, if it wasn't for him, none of this would have happened. The whole thing about me living up in northern Arizona, being a cowboy, being a hippie with no money, was all true. And the reason that Roger had a trio, Roger and Prairie and a guy named David, a bass player named David, and the only reason they decided to move to San Francisco was that Prairie got a scholarship to the San Francisco Art Institute.
Hmm.
So he's a very accomplished artist also. So he got a 3-year scholarship, and he went, well, we got to go. I can't pass this up. Yeah. You know, graduating from high school, he said, I can't pass this up. Well, I got to go. And so we went, oh, okay, well, we'll go with you. And so we all went to San Francisco. And the funny thing, we lived in a little 2-bedroom rat hole in the Sunset District of San Francisco, built on sand, a little wooden house built on sand that was condemned, but somehow the owner took down the condemned sign and rented it to us. There was five of us, the manager, Roger Prairie, David, and me. And we had a manager that we brought along at the time, a guy named John Spear. And we moved into this little shack, and we lived. Uncle Marshall. Prairie had an uncle. His name was Marshall. Uncle Marshall. And Uncle Marshall was so thrilled that Prairie got a scholarship to college or to an art school that Uncle Marshall ponied up $150 every month.
That really? Was his.
Uncle Marshall said, you know, I'll help support you. I'll give you $150 a month because I think it's great that you're going to go to art school.
Right.
And all five of us lived on $150 a month.
Oh, wow.
I was the cook. I was the roadie, the cook, the doctor, the maid. I was pretty much everything. And I would take, you know, Prairie, give me the $150, and I would go to Farmer's Market on the weekend and buy a 25-pound bag of brown rice and buy a 25-pound bag of pinto beans and buy a bunch of tortillas and a can of government cheese. I'll never forget it. It was cheese in a can. I don't know what kind of cheese, but it was in a can. It was like in a big gallon can of cheese. And that's every night I'd try to figure out how to make a different meal out of brown rice, pinto beans, and cheese. And
I love those stories.
It was classic. We called it Cheese Lake. It's pretty much it was something.
It's actually not a bad meal, you
lake
know.
Of cheese on your plate. So.
Yeah, not a bad
anyway,
meal
we,
really.
We started at the very bottom, man. I mean, we started at the bottom. We were playing CYO high school CYO dances, and. Oh man! I mean, we played any. That was the reason we ended up merging with Bill Spooner's band, also from Arizona, called the Beans. And Bill, you know, we told him about how, you know, Phoenix was back then in the early '70s. There was nothing happening in Phoenix. There was no bands. There was no music scene. There was nothing. And everybody wanted out who was in a band. And we talked to them, you know, we told them how great it was, and we lived in this great house on the beach. And of course, we were about 8 blocks from the beach, but it was sand. The backyard was all sand. And so they thought, oh, this is so great. So they all moved to San Francisco. His band moved to San Francisco. And they couldn't get a gig. They had no gigs. So we ended up merging the bands because we had gigs and they didn't. And they said, okay, well, we'll play your gigs. And, okay, well, let's have a big band. We'll have a great big Arizona. We didn't, I mean, it wasn't like, oh, no, we don't want more guys in the band because you have to pay them. There was no one was getting paid. So it was just, how do you make the Cheese Lake go around, you know, for everyone? So we joined with his band, and that was kind of the birth of the Tubes.
There was the Radar Men from Uranus. Who was in that band?
Well, what happened was the bass player, they fired the bass player, Roger.
Right.
We got this big trip in 1970. We went to Japan. The manager got us a gig in Japan at the Expo 70 in Osaka, Japan.
Okay.
And we went there representing San Francisco, which was a joke because we'd only been there about 4 months. But we went there and we played at the San Francisco Pavilion for 6 weeks, and he got us we got a free ride over on a cruise ship and a free ride back and 6 weeks in Japan, and they did like, you know, 4 sets a day or whatever, and David kept getting in trouble. He got in trouble with this, and he got in trouble with the police, and he got in trouble with this guy, and then on the way back home, he got in trouble with the preacher's daughter. who was on the boat. And so when we got back to San Francisco, he had just made the whole trip a nightmare for us, and they fired him. They fired him. They said, "Well, you're done. No, we'll find another bass player. We can't handle it." So he left, and that's when I started singing with the band, because I had been a singer my whole life, but they didn't know that. And so they wanted to rehearse but had no bass player. So since I knew all the material, I would go down to we rehearsed in our basement, and which was moldy sand. Oh, my God, I'll never forget it. So we started rehearsing, and I sang all the bass player's parts because he was the majority singer of Roger's band. And they looked and looked and looked for a bass player, and they couldn't find one. And the only guy they could find, because they played, they weren't a cover band. They were playing original material from the very beginning, kind of real whacked out, psychedelic Hendrix kind of rock and roll material. And they couldn't find a bass player, and the only guy that we could find was this guy who was already in five bands, and he didn't have time. And I just said, "Well, what'd you even show up for?" He goes, "Well, I don't know, So we ended up merging for two reasons. One, because we had gigs coming up with no bass player, mm-hmm. and the other, because Bill's band was there, and they didn't have any food or any money or any gigs, and so we said, "Well, we don't have a band, so we'll merge with your band, and we'll have two lead guitar players, two drummers, and keyboard and bass, right?" And that's where the Radar Men from Uranus came in. They said, "We don't need fee. We've got a bunch of," although then I was Fiji, probably still Fiji by then, but they said, "We don't need him. We already got roadies." And right. Roger got me the gig. Roger said, "Well, he's a pretty good singer. He's been singing David's parts, and he can mm-hmm. sing. So let him be the background singer." Okay, so they went, "Okay, fine, you can be the background singer." So we did. At our first gig, we didn't have enough material that we both knew. I mean, Bill had all his material, and we learned this one piece of material for Roger and Prairie to join in on. It was called The Ascension of the Motherlode. This was Spinal Tap before, way before. This was a Space Oddity, where it was this long, 30-minute long, spacey kind of piece that was never ending with a bunch of different, we had songs like Our Lord is a Hot Dog. That was one of the songs. And so in order to emphasize the spaceness of it all, Roger and Prairie and I, Bill would start the set. He'd do about a half an hour of their own material, their own normal songs. And then he would introduce The Ascension of the Motherlode, right, this space piece. Mm-hmm. And he would bring out the Radar Men from Uranus. And that was Prairie and Roger and I with Mylar and tin foil antennae. So we would dress up in made a cardboard Mylar silver space suit with tin foil antenna helmets.
Is that when the theatrics began?
That's when it began. It began right there when we came out to do that. And this was when I was still just a background singer, and Roger and Prairie were wearing, antennae, and we did this space piece, and we kept doing it. We had gigs, and so we kept doing gigs, and mm-hmm. Finally they just said, they said, "You sing way too loud. Why don't you sing lead, because you're way yep. too loud for a background singer." And, guitar players want to play guitar pretty much.
Right.
They don't really care about singing. I remember Bill used to sing with his back to the audience. I just went, "Well, dude, you can't get away with that. You can't, don't sing then. Just turn your back around and play your guitar, But you can't sing with your back to the audience." So I became the singer. And that's when it started. I became the lead singer, and I started doing costumes. And, there was a million bands in San Francisco in the early 70s. There was bands everywhere. And so in order to somehow stand out and get called back for the gig, you know, we started doing crazy stuff. We started doing costumes, and then it just we just got more and more and more elaborate. And then we hired dancers, and then we hired a choreographer, and then we started building props and sets and got a video guy. And we had live video before MTV, you know.
Although, and you got a break opening for Zeppelin, right, in 1973?
Yes, we did. We opened for Zeppelin. Well, I don't know if it was... I mean, they threw shit at us, pretty much.
Yeah, but you threw shit at them, too.
And I threw shit at them. We wanted to make a... You know, it was the Tubes opening at 10:30 in the morning. It was a daytime show. So everybody had camped out. It was at Kezar Stadium, which is the old 49ers football stadium that was abandoned in the heart of the city. And Lee Michaels was the second act, and then Zeppelin. And so we opened, and we did the whole show as Quaalude, you know, which is one of my characters, the kind of rock star character with the big platforms and who is pretty much taking too many drugs. And so I came out with the big, one big bag of white pills that I called Quaaludes, and although they were twice as big as a Quaalude, and they were sugar, and I threw them out to the audience. And then I had a big bag of white flour and told everybody it was cocaine, and I started scooping that off the stage in, you know, dust clouds of flour. And the hilarious thing was is the police that were there, they're the only ones who actually bought it. The crowd knew I was full of shit. They were throwing the pills back at me. But the police were going nuts, saying, oh, my God, he's got 14 pounds of cocaine in that bag, and he's throwing it to the audience. And they were ready to rush on the stage and bust us. And Bill Graham, this is a Bill Graham gig, you know, and Bill was on the – and Bill liked us. He liked it, that we were weird, and he used to hire us all the time. And Bill stopped him. He goes, look, dude, this is, you know, they're making $250 for this gig, okay? They can't afford 14 pounds of cocaine. And it's just a bit. And the cops just kind of went, oh, okay, whatever. So we pretty much, you know, they screamed Led Zeppelin at us the entire set and threw the pills back at us. So we kind of went, okay, well, great. And then we didn't, you know, the funny thing is, we got the gig from a guy whose name is Herbie Herbert. Mm-hmm. And Herbie Herbert went on to manage Journey, right? But before he managed Journey, he said, oh, I want to be you guys' manager. I'll make you stars. And, oh, okay. And then he was the one that got us the gig. He goes, I got you a gig. I'm showing you what I can. And I said, yeah, okay. And how much, you know? Well, it's only $250. And I said, well, okay, fine, whatever. And so we did the gig, and then Herbie stipped us for the money.
Oh, really? Oh, my God.
He stipped us for the $250. And we just went, well, dude, you know. He goes, well, it cost me a lot of money. You know, it's a lame excuse. And we went, okay, well, then you're not going to be our manager. We'll find somebody else, okay? we're not down with this. And so what happens? So he goes and finds Journey.
Journey, right? Yeah.
And sells 75 million albums.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Amazing.
But I don't have as many alimony payments as Neil has. Neil's, I think, got 4 or 5 by now, and I don't have any. So
I actually saw you throwing the Quaaludes and the cocaine out in an audience. I was there. I was
you
not
were at
Zeppelin.
That show?
No, I wasn't at the show, but about a year later, You came to Washington, D.C., and you did it in the audience. And I thought it was the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life. It was awesome.
We used to throw, we had a song called Wonder Bread Bodies.
Uh-huh.
And I used to go to the day-old bread store and buy day-old loaves of Wonder Bread. And I would come out, and that also backfired. People, you know, I would wad them up and throw bread to the audience singing Wonder Bread Bodies, and then they would throw it back at me. Wad it up and throw it back on the stage. So I pretty much don't throw things at the audience anymore.
I talked to Arthur Brown, and he stopped doing the fire on his head, because it got too dangerous.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Michael Jackson caught his hair on fire, so hell.
That's right. That's right.
And that was, and this guy actually had a campfire on his head. Jeez. I remember.
You know, the Quaalude character, I don't know how the hell you kept balance with those. How tall were you actually with those shoes on?
I still wear them. They're 18 inches.
18 inches?
The heel measures 18 inches, yes. And we made them, we made them out of fiberglass, so they're not that heavy, although they're it's kind of a pair of beetle boots that I ripped the heel off of,
right.
And then we built this bottom on it and kind of made it to look like bondage shoes, like bondage ballerina shoes kind of look. You know, from a bondage catalog we had. Oh, yeah, that's good. It's really good.
Did you create the Quay character?
Yep. I did. I did Quaalude.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to do... Actually, the inspiration for Quaalude was David Johansen, was New York Dolls.
Right.
Like I said, Bill Graham used to love to hire us. Mm-hmm. And... we opened for Kiss, and we opened for Bruce Springsteen, and we opened for New York Dolls, and we opened for all kinds of Iggy Pop and all kinds of people. And we had a gig to open for the New York Dolls, and it was at a club in San Francisco, and they showed up for the sound check, and they were all glammed out top to bottom, wearing platforms and big hair and scarves and jewelry and. I was naive, and I thought, I thought you guys were like normal people, and just pretty much did this on stage. This was a bit that you did. This was your bit, and because we were all, we were all just normal, and but no, this is what they were always, and they were drunk and still. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. They were drunk and whacked out on, I don't know what. And stumbling around and wearing, and David was wearing great big, like 4 or 5 inch platforms. You could hardly walk. And it was just so, I just thought, my God, who are you? It's a sound check, okay? Who are you trying to impress, okay? I don't get it. But, and that's just the, he goes, this is the way, this is me. This is the way I am all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then we had to, take the piss out. We had to make fun of them like we always do. And, and this is funny. This is a good story. The first pair of Quaalude platform shoes, the first pair I had Beetle boots. I didn't have platforms that big.
Right.
I didn't have 5-inch silver platforms. So what I did was I took 2-quart tomato juice cans. Remember tomato juice used to come in a big quart can?
Yep.
And it was kind of ribbed around the middle. So I dumped out the tomato juice, right? And I gaffer taped them through the bottom of my Beetle boots and then sprayed it silver, right? And so, that a tomato juice can is maybe 8 or 10 inches high. Maybe,
mm-hmm. Right.
Like, and so... I wore this hokey wig, and I was trying to be a glam rocker.
Glam rocker,
and
right?
Wore like a tube top and tight pants and these jokey shoes, right? And we came out and we sang "White Punks on Dope," which is signature Quaalude song.
Mm-hmm.
And the cans, as I sang, the cans began to collapse because they were ribbed in the middle, around. So. I started with, 10-inch platform shoes at the beginning of the song, and by the end of the song, the cans had completely collapsed, accordioned down to, 1 inch.
That's great.
And I thought, this is no good. And then, the next time we did it, I figured, if I don't take out the tomato juice, they won't collapse. And so I taped them to my shoes with 2 full cans of tomato shoes. They weighed about 3 pounds each.
Yep.
And so that was useless because I couldn't move. I couldn't walk, with these 2 giant tomato juice cans on each foot. So
the things you do for rock and roll, I'm telling you.
I know. So we basically failed on, went for the, we went to the actual, let's make some real, you know, we had a bunch of guys, we had a video guy, and we had a guy who made props for us, and, you know, I said, make me some real platforms that are just really big.
You know, White Punks on Dope was my high school's anthem.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It was, what a great song. And, you know, you guys always had, you know, A-plus musicians. So, you know, you always took the band very seriously because they were, you know, well-tuned, you know.
Right.
And what's cool about the finale, I guess, of White Punks on Dope, you have the Kill amplifiers, right, falling on top of you.
Oh, yeah, the earthquake. Right. Well, it was San Francisco. Yeah, we had big fake cardboard amps that,
right,
you know, that we would, they all kind of one fit inside each other, so that's always, although that didn't help. I mean, they were cardboard, so they didn't,
It looked real. It actually did look real.
Yeah, it was amazing. And then crew would push them over, and I'd crush quite a bit. So I used to get crushed every night. You know.
You actually broke your leg on stage once, right, during the Johnny Bugger character?
I broke my leg in Leicester, England, on our, it was 78, I think. 78. We had a big, and the funny thing was I didn't do it wearing the platform shoes. I did it doing the punk character, which was kind of our piss take of Johnny Rotten of Sex Pistols, right?
Right, right.
And I thought he was great, and so I used to do the punk guy, and we had a big tour, like a 60-show European tour. And it was Leicester, England. It was one of the warm-up shows. I think we did three warm-ups before we started London. And so a third show, I fall off. It was really dark. I'm wearing these really dark punk glasses where I can't see what the hell I'm doing. And I'm swinging a chainsaw around my head.
Oh,
right?
Man.
Johnny used to. It didn't have a blade on it. It just was. You know, I didn't want to cut my leg off, but. It was a chainsaw that was running, so you can't see the blade turning anyway, so people couldn't tell. And so the chainsaw, and the bit was I would jump off the stage and I'd run down the middle aisle of the theater, swinging the chainsaw around my head, smoking, stinking, you know, and just scare the hell out of everybody. And, but I missed the edge of the stage. When I went to jump off the edge, which was about maybe 5 or 6 feet high stage, I missed the last step. Instead of stepping to the edge, I stepped over the edge,
right,
and just went off into space, broke my right leg just above fibula, right above the ankle, and hit the deck, and everyone thought it was part of the show.
Yeah, I would too.
That was great, pratfall, great. And I just laid there. Nobody came to my rescue. Nobody got up to see how I was doing, nothing. I'm just laying there on the ground, and I knew, I could feel it. I mean, it broke. I could feel it break. I could feel the snap in my leg, and I knew, I'm fucked. You'll have to edit that part out. I knew it was broken. So I know I'm done. The whole thing is over. I'm done. And I'm laying there, and the chainsaw's still running. It's like I'm flat on my back, no one's coming to help, and the chainsaw is just sitting there running. And so, you know, the band is kind of looking down at me going, okay, well, come on, let's go. You got to jump back up here and finish the song. And, you know, and I just looked up, I just went, no. And I kind of got up, and I tried to put a little weight on my leg, on my right leg, nothing. It was completely numb. And just jelly, you know. I couldn't put weight on it. I couldn't feel it. It was gone. And I just kind of hopped off.
Oh, you hopped off?
Couldn't get back on the stage.
I
had to like hop around the side of the stage to get backstage, and you know, turn off the chainsaw. And by then, you know, my leg is big around as a basketball. Mm. And that was it. They just went, okay, you're straight to the hospital.
Yeah,
we're done. Tour over.
They had to cancel the tour, right?
Yeah, they canceled 60 shows.
Wow.
They actually wanted me to just do the London show in a wheelchair.
Right.
Because it was such a big deal. And I just went, no, I can't, no. I refused. I said, I'm not going to do it in a wheelchair. After, I mean, people paid money to see this big extravaganza with dancers and jumping and, you know, one-legged ballerinas.
Yeah.
And no, I'm not going to do it. So I said, you got to reschedule.
Well, you know,
so they did. I went home. We all went home. I took off 3 or 4 months for my leg to heal up.
Right.
And I think that was in May. And then we ended up rescheduling for a September-October tour and went back over and made up all those dates.
You know, you have a great voice. You have a really good, excellent rock and roll voice. One of the songs, you know, She's a Beauty, was a great tune, which actually, I think, made it to the top 10. Wasn't that your biggest hit?
Actually, She's a Beauty went to number 2.
Oh, it got to number 2. Okay.
Number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100. We never had, you know, never. I have this T-shirt that says number 1 with a bullet, and it's got the Billboard Hot 100 star with a 1 in the middle of it, and I can't wear it. I've never worn it. It's just there in the suitcase. I thought, well, so no, I guess I'm never going to know. I don't know. But
pretty darn close.
It didn't make it. It was number 2, I believe.
Great song.
Yeah, I you know, I'm lucky vocally. I'm really lucky because in the early days, I used to have trouble with my voice. You know, I would push too hard. I would strain it, and I'd lose my voice. And, you know, back then we used to work just ridiculous. I mean, I looked at an old itinerary the other day. I was going through a pile of crap looking for something, and I saw an old itinerary from the 80s or late 70s, and we did like 13 in a row, 13 one-night different cities in a row. And I can't imagine how I could have done that. I mean, today my limit is 4. I won't let them book more than 4 in a row. That's it.
Right.
But I used to, you know, I didn't know how to control my voice and in the early days, and I went to a speech therapist. I met this person who said, you know, I can show you how to not strain your voice and save yourself. And, you know, because, you know, you sing 20, 25 songs every night for 13 nights in a row, you're getting pretty strained. And I used to do acupuncture. You know, I used to go to a city, my voice is hurting, I would find an acupuncturist and go to them during the day, and an Asian one preferably, and they would stick needles in my vocal cords.
Oh, really? Holy crap.
Right in my neck, right into the vocal cord.
Wow.
And sometimes they would put a little electrical charge on it. But, I mean, it's a miracle. It worked every time. You know, I'd walk out of there just singing like a bird. I couldn't believe it, you know. But the speech therapist told me, trained me how to use, to not have to push. They call it belting. You know, belting means like you're really pushing hard from your diaphragm.
Right.
And a lot of old time, like 40s kind of singers used to, Della Reese and stuff, they used to be big belters. And Frank never belted, and Frank must have known that you use your not Frank Stallone either. It's funny, Frank Stallone is you know, I've always been a huge Sinatra fan, and we do Sinatra in the show, and we do This Town, which is a Frank Sinatra song. And, but this, my friend at I go to this gym in Venice here. I go to Gold's Gym in Venice, and Frank Stallone is always there,
right?
And he's a big fan, and he always, hey, what's happening, Fever? And he's playing some horrible lounge, you know, some horrible lounge. And he's going, you got to come to see me and the lounge act at Vitelli's or some, you know,
bad
mafia Italian restaurant. And, and I you know, it's like daily practically, and I have to come up with, oh, you know, Wednesdays are really bad for me, Frank. Wednesday's my day when I have to do this, or I have to, you know, I have to go to the lobby of the hotel and wait for the limo. But
I wanted to point out to the or listening audience, if you want to listen to Fee, just his music without the tubes, and just, you know, witness how great of a voice he has. There's a couple of great songs, cover songs on YouTube. One is he does "Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds," I really enjoy that song. You're on the album, I guess that Billy Sherwood did, and you did "Another Walk Brick in the Wall" too, right?
I did what?
"Another Brick in the Wall" Part Two, and
I did "Walk This Way" on an Aerosmith tribute,
right?
And I did a. What did I do with Billy's a good friend, and I love working with him.
He's a good guy. Yeah,
I did.
I think you did a Pink Floyd. I did a
ZZ Top song.
Well, I heard "Mother" from Pink Floyd. I heard "Another Brick in the Wall." Oh. I think you did that with Ronnie Montrose. Was also part of that on that song.
Could have been. I mean, they did everybody separately. So I don't know. You know. I didn't know at that point who would be playing. Billy played everything on the demo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Billy's amazing. He plays guitar and drums, and he puts this whole demo thing together for me to sing to. And then he comes in and brings these heavy hitters in to replace his guide tracks. You know.
Yeah, we had Billy on the show.
I was going to say so the speech therapist really helped me save my voice and taught me how to bounce the sound off your upper, your hard palate, the upper palate in your mouth.
That's
and it's like a soundboard, he said. Huh. You don't have to push so hard because that's going to amplify it for you, and you don't have to belt. And so I've been really fortunate over all these years, and I never had nodes. I never had any kind of problem with my voice other than, you know, strain from too many shows. And, and I've, you know, shit, I've been really, and we don't have to, you know, a lot of bands lower the key of the song because the singer can't hit the high notes anymore.
That's right.
We don't do that. We've never had to do that, thank God. Hmm. Knock on wood.
Well, you have a great, you have a powerful voice, and you can sing over any guitarist. No problem.
Yeah, it's the drummer. I hate them. It's the drummers. I'm always standing in front of the drum kit with the cymbal right about my ear.
That's got to be tough.
Right. I always tell him, hurry, can you just turn that down a little bit?
Yeah, exactly.
Can you just turn it down? So, don't you have a knob for that? Used to it, man.
Do you ever play golf with Alice Cooper, since he's from Arizona as well?
Yeah. Well, yeah? I mean, I've played in his tournament. I don't really play. I mean, golf. I don't have 5 hours to go spend playing golf.
Right,
I just don't
have
it. I play celebrity golf, which means you can get away with being loud, you know, a bad golfer because you're a celebrity.
Right.
You're going to do stupid stuff like putt with a polo mallet, which I've done a few times. I play polo. My love is, I used to be a baseball player. I played ball my whole life. My dad actually started Little League in Scottsdale, Arizona. So I started playing baseball when I was like 6 or 7 years old.
Right.
And I've always played ball, and so when I kind of transitioned to playing polo, it was easy for me because it's just stick and ball, you know, it's just a longer stick than a 34 baseball bat. The same size.
What position did you play in baseball?
I played first base pretty much my whole career. I played first base. And then I started playing fast pitch softball when I moved to LA.
Right.
And fast pitch softball is pretty much a women's sport now. There are really not many men playing fast pitch anymore. You know, they all play slow pitch and they just toss it up there and see how far you can hit it. But I ended my career playing catcher, actually.
Really? Really?
Because nobody wanted to catch, you know? And it was the guaranteed way to make the lineup because we had a really good team. We went to the Nationals. My L.A. team, it was called Malibu. Mm-hmm. The Malibu Breakers, I think it was called. And we went to the B-League Nationals 3 or 4 times. So we had a lot of good players, a lot of good pitchers, and nobody wanted – we had one guy that was just – we called him Breeder. He was a great big, you know, 400-pound, huge guy. And he could throw that ball. Oh my God, he could pitch windmill like nobody's business, and
really?
Nobody wanted to catch him, nobody. Yeah. And so I kind of became friends with him, and I said, okay, Dave, well, I'll catch. I'm too big to catch, but you know, I did it anyway. So it was, and then the fast pitch kind of fell apart, and my brother actually, who's a horseman, I have a little brother who lives in Scottsdale still, and. He's always had horses, and he's the one who said, man, you know, I found this great thing to do, riding horses. Because we grew up on horses. I grew up on, my family had horses when I was a kid in Scottsdale, so I was riding horses as well as playing ball. And so you said polo. So I found a polo club here in L.A. Actually, I'm playing tonight at the California Polo Club.
And, all right.
We play Thursday night and Saturday morning. And I went to do it, and, you know, I hadn't been in the saddle for, God, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went out there, and they said, okay, well, the first lesson's free. And I went, okay, that's not good. That means that it must be really fun, and I'm going to be hooked immediately. And so sure enough, it was really fun, and it seemed... Not that, you know, people have a really hard time hitting the ball. And mm-hmm. I had, you know, like I said, I had played ball my whole life hitting the little ball. And I just hit the ball like nobody, you know, there was no problem at all. They went, wow, you can really hit, you know. And so I went, yeah, well, you know, this doesn't seem to be that hard. And little did I know. And then so that was it. I was, you know, well, I'll buy a block of 10 lessons, and then I'll buy another 10 more lessons. And then, okay, well, you better get a helmet of your own and shoes and boots of your own.
Yeah.
And then, you better get a saddle of your own, too. And then you better get a horse of your own, because riding rental horses, at some point, it gets, you know, you get too good to be riding a rental horse who doesn't want to be there. And and then I bought a horse, and then I bought another horse, and then I actually own 5 horses now.
Five horses.
Wikipedia, that's an update. Yeah, 5 horses.
Now, when you play polo, do you use the same horse, or do you mix it up?
No, a polo game consists of 4 periods.
Okay.
Each period, they call them chuckers.
Right.
And a chucker is 7 minutes and 30 seconds long.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're playing a polo game, a low-level, a recreational-level polo game, polo goes from 4 chuckers to 6 chuckers to 8 chuckers for the way high-end U.S. Open kind of polo. But to play a 4-chucker game, you know, you pretty much need to change horses every chucker.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
So I play 4 chuckers and ride 4 horses. I have 4 bridles, 4 saddles, 4 everything. And, I mean, you don't have to, but the more competitive you get, the harder it is on your horse. So you couldn't, like, have one horse and play a 4-chucker game by the end. Your horse would be, you know, crawling around on its knees because it's just beat up, you know.
Huh.
So some people double chucker, but, you know, it's too much trouble. And I'm too big. I'm too big to play polo. All the polo, Argentine polo pros are these little guys. They're little, they're 5'8" and 140 pounds. It's like a jockey or something, you know. And
how tall are you, Fee?
I'm 6'3".
6'3". That's not too big.
200 pounds.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty big for, you know, and I the first horse I bought was this little normal polo pony, you know. It was about 15. Well, forget about it. It's too, I have the biggest horses in the barn now.
Right, right.
Without a doubt. I have the 4 biggest polo horses in the barn.
Hmm.
And we have a barn at the polo club. We have about a 60-stall horse barn at the polo club. And they have a bunch of, you know, rental horses, and then they have a bunch of club members who own horses that are boarding them there.
Yeah. Now, how do they keep standings? I mean, is that on your own? You're not as part of a team, right? It's kind of like tennis, where you're ranked or something like that. How's that work?
Yes. Everybody has a handicap from -2 to 10,
okay,
ending best, and So you start out as a minus two, and then, you know, you kind of progress upwards. I'm a one. I've been playing for 12 years, and I'm only a one. That's how hard it is. It's really hard. And to get up, you know, up into the higher stratosphere, like the 10-goal players of today, are just, I mean, it's just, they're playing a different game. It's unbelievable what they can do. It's just unbelievable. I just watched the U.S. Open was on NBC just last weekend, and the best player in the world, Adolfo Cambiaso, the best players are all Argentines. Everybody, it's like in Argentina, instead of growing up playing Little League baseball, you grow up playing polo. So these Argentines have been playing, you know, since they could pretty much walk practically.
Yeah.
You know, so it's the kids grow up there wanting to be famous polo players instead of wanting to be Mickey Mantle, you know.
I always considered polo to be like a rich man's sport as well.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, it is. Yeah. It is, but there is a recreational end, the low end, the low recreational end, as opposed to the top end where Cambiaso gets $1 million to play the U.S. Open from his sponsor guy. At the low end, on my end, you know, we just play the other club members. We don't play for money. We don't do, you know, it doesn't cost anything other than the board for your horse.
Right.
You know, we just show up on Thursday, and everybody's a club member. Everybody knows everybody, and we just kind of pick teams and play. You know, and so it's pretty casual. You know, it's not. And, you know, you can hire pros and play tournaments and spend a lot of money if you want to. You can spend a lot of money on.
We've got just a few more minutes before we have to wrap up.
Okay.
Talk to me about it. What's next for the Tubes? Is there going to be a new album coming out?
Probably not.
Okay.
No. Actually, we're going to release a. When we were in Europe last year, last summer, we were approached by a German company who have a live Tubes live in a German TV show from 1982, and it was a full on. It was a whole show. It was like an hour and a half.
Right.
Full-on production with the dancers and the props and the whole thing, with a bunch of great camera angles. And so we're going to release this DVD this summer, probably. It's a DVD and a CD.
Oh, great.
In one package.
Wonderful.
By this German, it's called Serena Records, I think it is. It's a German company. So we are going to have a product out for the summer. And and then we're going to go to Europe in September and do about a five-week European tour. Mostly, UK, 12 shows in the UK, and then Germany, Holland, Scandinavia, whatever. Go ahead.
And of course, we've got the Capitol Theater. Coming up
Capitol
on June 3rd at that'll be the Tubes at the Capitol Theater with John Waite, and I guess you're going to be also in May 27th. You'll be in New Jersey as well.
Yeah, we're playing actually the New Jersey Performing Arts Center.
Right.
On the 28th,
gotcha.
I guess, of May.
Yep.
We're playing with Todd.
Right.
And you know, Prairie's out with Todd, so
yep.
They called us up and said, "You guys want to play together?" And I said, "Yeah, well,
why not?"
We have, the drummer's already there. He's
yeah,
just
exactly.
Saving a plane ticket.
Thee, I want to thank you so much, man, for being on the show today and for all the incredible shows that you've given us with the Tubes and continue to bring. Good luck on the tour. Maybe I'll get to see you in Clearwater.
Well, let me know if you want to. You know, I'll put you on the guest list.
That'll be great.
Email me. You have my email address. Email me.
I do.
Let me know if you can make it. And
sure. I'll cover the show for you and do a review as well.
Okay. That would be good.
All right, Fee.
Okay, well,
thank you so
you,
much.
Ray. I appreciate you taking time out for me, and especially since I changed the time like four times.
No problem. No problem.
And you guys managed to roll with it, so I really appreciate that. That's
not
great.
A problem. It's been wonderful. You're a good guy.
Okay, well, thank you, Ray. Appreciate your help.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Okay, bye-bye.
The Tubes continue touring the U.S. and Europe in 2016. Visit www.thetubes.com for a complete schedule of their live shows. For information on Fee Waybill and the Tubes and latest tour dates, visit their official website at www.thetubes.com. You can also look them up on Facebook, www.facebook.com/thetubes, and they are also on Twitter, twitter.com/thetubesgroup/thetubesgroup. Coming up next on the Ray Shasho Show, Janet Robbins, proficient multi-instrumentalist and vocalist, and the daughter of country music icon Marty Robbins. Join me bi-weekly, Mondays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, on the Ray Shasho Show. Very special thanks to Fee Waybill for this interview today, and thanks to Don and Doug Newsom with BBS Radio for making it all happen every show. If you have comments or suggestions or would like to be a guest on the Ray Shasho Show, call 941-877-1552 or email us at ray@publicityworksagency.com. And don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and the Wacky Family Business, available now at amazon.com. You'll live it. Have a great weekend. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com. Specializing in author and music artist publicity plans, we shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio, Station 1.